It's United States against Johnny Collins. Mr. Teal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Andrew Teal. I represent Johnny Collins. And the case today, Mr. Collins asked this Court to revisit its jurisprudence with respect to the application of the exclusionary rule for violations of the Fourth Amendment in the context of excessive force. Mr. Collins understands that the current status of the law as set forth by this Court in U.S. versus Watson is that excessive force violations of the Fourth Amendment do not currently avail a defendant of the exclusionary rule. We're asking this Court to reconsider that.
Given Hudson versus Michigan, is there any warrant for us to do so?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that, with all due respect, the review of Hudson in Watson is incomplete. Because what Hudson did not simply say there are exceptions to the exclusionary rule. Hudson set out a framework by which courts can review specific instances of the application of the exclusionary rule and determine whether those particular violations should fall within the exclusionary rule. As this court...
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a choice, in a sense, between exclusion of evidence when there's a Fourth Amendment violation and a damages remedy, and perhaps there's a third choice of doing nothing, but let's just assume it's the first two, exclusion versus damages. And the Supreme Court casts it that way in Hudson and says, well, knock and announce is not one of those situations where exclusion is an appropriate remedy. So why doesn't the same logic apply here?
Well, I would point out two points. One is perhaps a factual distinction, but both Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia in Hudson both say that that decision is confined to the knock and announce scenario. So it does not have broad application, certainly not to the excessive force scenario. But what Hudson sets up is that there has to be a balancing test. And that balancing test has to be between what Justice Scalia called the substantial social costs and the deterrence effect of the exclusionary rule. And indeed, this court recognizes that the main value, or indeed purpose, of the exclusionary rule is that deterrence to future police misconduct. And I would submit that that balancing test, when it is applied to excessive force violations, supports the actual use of the exclusionary rule in those situations. And if we want to walk through exactly what Justice Scalia said in Hudson, he identifies two substantial social costs which do not apply in this case and, frankly, do not apply generally, I don't believe, to the exclusionary rule. The first is the risk of setting criminals free, and the second is the risk of increasing exclusionary litigation. And I would point out, indeed, as Justice Breyer pointed out in his dissent, that these are not criticisms of specific applications of the exclusionary rule. These are criticisms of the rule themselves, a rule that has been in our jurisprudence for more than a century.
My guess is that Justice Scalia knows that.
I have no doubt that he does, Your Honor. But I would submit to you that even in the case of a warrantless search, which is undoubtedly subject to the exclusionary rule, there is a risk of setting criminals free, and there is a risk of exclusionary litigation.
But your reasons for not liking damages equally apply to everything. I mean, damages cases are subject to various qualified immunity rules. Damages cases might proceed against somebody who's going to be indemnified. Okay, you know, that's understood as well. But these are the remedies that we have on the table, and trying to be faithful to the theme of Hudson, if not the particular facts, this court has decided that this kind of situation is one that's not one that leads to exclusion.
Now, I think your first point, perhaps, I would go to say, you know, the 1983 claims, the position that those are an effective deterrent, I believe simply ignores the actual realities of the situation. And I think that we can find that in Hudson, because what Hudson says is that, well, there simply just aren't that many knock-and-announce cases out there. There aren't that many where there is a large judgment awarded. So that these damage cases really do have some sort of deterrence effect.
But look at the facts of Bivens itself. That's exactly, you know, people go and they rampage through somebody's apartment. I mean, the notion of a private remedy for these things is not new.
No, it's certainly not. And I think if the purpose of the exclusionary rule was to compensate somehow the aggrieved party, then perhaps this idea that the damages remedy is an appropriate substitution makes sense. But that's not the purpose of the exclusionary rule. The purpose and the stated purpose both by the United States Supreme Court and by this Court is to deter future actions by police officers. And in a former professional life, this is what I did, is I defended these police officers. And I can tell you that it simply does not deter for a number of reasons. The first, quite frankly, is that they don't pay judgments. They never do. Either the municipality or the insurance company pays those judgments. But the second is that they don't suffer adverse employment results from these particular judgments. The last case that I believe your colleague, Judge Hamilton, tried was a case that I also tried, and there was a $2 million judgment against an officer. And that officer paid none of that judgment, and in fact, he retained his job as town marshal in the town that he was marshal prior to that. So to say that somehow the application of a damages remedy that is paid by an insurance company and that does not result in an adverse employment action somehow results in substantial deterrence of future police activity, I think is just quite simply wrong. And it's particularly wrong when you look at the actual balancing that Hudson actually requires. So I would submit that not only that, frankly, Watson does not have support in this particular circuit's jurisprudence otherwise, in that this circuit requires a deterrence effect, and it does not find support in Watson. Moreover, it simply does not find support in any other circuit. In fact, this is the only circuit where Mr. Collins could not have enjoyed the remedy of exclusion. There are two specific circuits which explicitly have said that this remedy would have been available, and that's the Ninth Circuit in U.S. versus Ankeny and the Fourth Circuit in U.S. versus Edwards.
But the Ninth Circuit just also concludes there's no causal nexus between the evidence and the alleged excessive force, so it's really not quite as square as you're making it out to be.
Well, but I think you can read between the lines there and say, if they had wanted to say there's quite simply no remedy, they could have said there's no remedy. And what they did was they said, they went actually into a discussion of whether this particular defendant was entitled to the remedy, which I think the rational assumption to be taken from that is, in fact, that there is a remedy in the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah. When's the last time that the exclusionary rule has been extended to a new context?
Into a new context?
That's what you're asking us to do.
I don't believe that I am, Your Honor. The exclusionary rule is intended to apply to Fourth Amendment violations.
Well, right, to a new Fourth Amendment context like excessive use of force. That's what you're asking for, an extension of the exclusionary rule to apply to evidence obtained via the excessive use of force. We've got other problems factually in this
sure.
case, in that the evidence was dropped before contact was made.
I am happy to address that as well, certainly. I think that, with all due respect, Your Honor, that we're looking at the question the wrong way. Because, the original purpose of the exclusionary rule was to remedy Fourth Amendment violations. And there have always been exclusions to that rule. Going back 50, 60 years, there were exclusions where there was no deterrent effect, and there were exclusions for non-criminal proceedings. And so the real issue is, does this fall under those recognized exclusions, not are we broadening the exclusionary remedy?
You're asking us to ignore lots of intervening case law that has focused on this deterrence rationale in evaluating whether to extend the exclusionary rule.
Again, I think I'm asking you, the court, to review its own jurisprudence, yes, but I think I'm asking it to review that jurisprudence in the context of the other circuits and indeed the United States Supreme Court's own opinions. I noticed that my
case,
time is
in
up.
This case of the thrown away drugs,
yeah.
Well, there's a chase going on, no arrest, and they haven't caught him yet. So that is not going to be excluded.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think there is federal jurisprudence which would perhaps change that authority. And I would specifically point you, as I did in my brief, to Clark v. Thomas from the District Court of Kansas, which recognizes that perhaps it, unlike in probable cause cases like Hodari D. or in search and seizure cases or indeed in knock and announce cases, the excessive force cases are often evolving scenarios. So in that case, the court said in denying summary judgment on an excessive force claim that we need to look not at just the application of force, but the entire event. And that included, in that case, the officer ignoring a direct order of his superior to terminate the chase, which is exactly what we have here. Excuse me?
Could that be anything when you cease the chase? He's talking about the chase with the vehicle, which endangers a lot of people. That's why they want to stop the chase. Well, the guy wrecks the car at the same time, so everybody's out of the car. The so-called chase is over, isn't it?
Well, I think the facts...
I don't see why, in any event, a violation of a state police code rises to the level of a Fourth Amendment violation. I know it's a but-for, you know, but for waking up in the morning, he wouldn't have done it either, but, you know... It really is just a violation of the state police code.
Well, I
mean, at most. Maybe not even that, as Judge Mannion says. Anyway, if you want to respond very quickly to that, I think your time is up.
Again, I would point, Your Honor, that, frankly, the District Court of Kansas disagrees with you. I mean, it took that into consideration as one of the factors into whether or not this was a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Holler.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. We believe that the Court's decision in Watson is sound and it should not be overruled. Even if the Court were inclined to overrule Watson, it should look at doing that in a case where it would matter. And as the Court has explained, I believe in its questions already, it could not possibly do so in this case. Just to take brief issue with a couple of things that the defendant did say, however, I believe that in Watson, this Court considered Hudson and evaluated it. This Court considered Ankeny and evaluated it. And I would dispute the defendant's characterization of Edwards as disagreeing with Watson. The majority opinion in Edwards finds that the government waived any sort of Watson-based or Hudson-based claim. And, in fact, in dissent, Judge Diaz, as I read its opinion, specifically embraces Watson. So I don't think that there is any judge of any federal court on point that has disagreed with Watson. And under these circumstances, this Court has repeatedly said that it's not going to sort of twist in the wind and go back and forth on how it interprets law. So we believe this Court should affirm Watson unless or until there is some specific reason from reasoning in other courts or other methods to disagree with it. I also disagree with the defendant's characterization of Clark. In fact, Clark, to the extent this Court wants to consider the District Court of Kansas's opinion, Clark is a 1983 action. I think it supports the claim that 1983 actions can be used to deter officers and that the suppression of evidence and the release of a criminal is not the best way to do that. I also think that
the Supreme Court at least seems to think that damages actions have some deterrent value.
I think that that's true. I think that they do as well, but ultimately it's what they say that matters more so than what either myself or Mr. Thiel says. And as a factual matter, the Clark case is distinguishable because on the facts of Clark, the officer in that case struck the defendant's car, and that's a seizure. And once the seizure happens, you can take all other kinds of factors into consideration in deciding whether excessive force was applied. The defendant sort of tries to, I think, you know, at various points try to figure out exactly when he thinks his constitutional violation started. In a pro se supplemental brief, the defendant, Mr. Collins himself, tries to claim that he wasn't even speeding, and I think that this Court obviously is not going to, on clear error review, overturn Judge Springman's finding on that matter. I think I agree with you, Judge Mannion, and I think the video as well bears out that at the exact moment in Exhibit 1 that the defendant is sort of trying to make this turn and careening into the stop sign is right about when the officer, Sergeant Long, is saying terminate the pursuit. That's terminate the vehicle pursuit as interpreted by Officer Ealing. But as you pointed out, Judge Wood, even if there's some dispute about that and you know, the defendant or Mr. Ealing, Officer Ealing, was supposed to stop his car and do nothing further, and he misinterpreted that, that's a matter for the Fort Wayne Police Department. That's not a violation of the United States Constitution. And even if it's a violation of Indiana law or Fort Wayne Municipal Code, Virginia versus Moore says the exclusionary rule doesn't apply to that. It only applies to Fourth Amendment violations, which we don't have here. And then, as Judge Sykes pointed out, California versus Hodari D pretty squarely forecloses any claim regarding the drugs because no violation could have possibly occurred until force is actually physically imposed through the striking and the attempt to stop Mr. Collins.
We actually had two seizures here. We had a traffic stop that was initiated, which was the initial seizure, and then he flees from that. So what we're looking at is what happened
I think
further
so.
Down the road.
I think so. I think Griffin and the Marion versus City of Corydon case sort of established that. I mean, yeah, if there had been a violation on the first seizure, we would start from there. But I don't see anybody contesting that. And then once he's fleeing again, now it's not just a speeding violation. Now it's a resisting violation. So there's a new crime that he has to be seized on, I guess is how I would view it. So I don't think that has any application here. And then really with the cash, once we get to the point where he's striking the defendant, the constitutional standard essentially is, was the force reasonably necessary to effectuate the arrest? Well, if it was, then it doesn't violate the Constitution. And if it wasn't, then it didn't cause the violation, because by sort of definition as a tautology, he didn't need to use the force in order to make the arrest and search him to retrieve the cash. So since the defendant, I don't think, can even identify a Fourth Amendment violation that would have caused him the harm he says here, I don't think even Ankeny, even the Ninth Circuit's opinion, would come into play, and therefore there's no reason for this court to worry about any definitional dispute. So I think that's a long way of saying the court should simply reaffirm Watson.
You see the harm that he's asserting is the discovery of the evidence.
The
discomfort of being beat up and having to be taken to the hospital.
No, I believe there's certainly he's asserting a harm. He's asserting that his harm, well, at various places, I mean, he has also said the harm was from the officer's order to cease the pursuit. But I think best understood in the way the district court understood it, his harm is the hospital bills, the results of the tasing, all of that. But that harm, I mean, didn't cause the discovery of the evidence. The remedy he wants, he doesn't want to sue the officer, and he doesn't want to get his hospital bills paid by the officer or the city of Fort Wayne or whatever insurance company indemnifies the city of Fort Wayne. He wants the drugs and the cash thrown out of his criminal trial so he can beat the rap. And that's what we're saying is, I think the Supreme Court and this court as well repeatedly has said, the closer fit to the harm that he suffered is to have him sue and get money for the damages, not throw out some evidence that would have been discovered anyway, whether or not he'd been beaten up. And that's why we believe the court has cut back on the exclusionary rule and has suggested that, as in Hudson, as in Ramirez, the proper remedy here is a 1983 action. So if the defendant doesn't wish to pursue one, that's certainly his right, but he has no right to suppression of the evidence in a criminal case, and therefore the district court's decision in this case was correct, and this court should affirm. If the court has no further questions, we stand on our brief.
Thank you, Nat. I think you ran out of time, but we'll give you one final minute if you would like.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few quick points. First, I find it hard to believe that the government is honestly going to argue that there was no violation of the Fourth Amendment here. We had an unarmed individual who was kicked and punched dozens of times, who was subjected to enough pepper spray that his eyes were swollen shut, and then had the use of deadly force applied to him twice, all the while he was unarmed the entire time. So, frankly,
he was resisting pretty wildly, though, wasn't he?
No, with all due respect, Your Honor. There was no contact ever made with the officer. The officer suffered no injuries as a result of this. There may have been flight, but I think that there was a real lack of enough active resistance to support this kind of force.
There was a large disparity in size, as I recall. Your guy was...
There was also a large disparity in age,
pounds.
Your Honor. But my client is in his 50s. Officer Ealing is much younger than that.
Old guys are tough, too, huh?
Trust me, every day I feel it. I would like to just briefly, in the time I have remaining, address this Hodari D idea. Because I think what we're looking at in this particular case is the sort of, and I'm going to call it the moral hazard.
You'll need to be quick, but we will let you.
The moral hazard that Justice Breyer talked about, and that is the ability of officers to feel that they can violate the Fourth Amendment with impunity. In this case, if we're going to sanction this sort of effort, basically all we're saying is, so long as we've actually found the evidence, officers, go ahead and do whatever you want. You can go ahead and beat this guy up. You can go ahead and almost kill him.
Well,
we're not going to have any sort of actual deterrent value in that.
Okay, I think maybe we'll leave it at that. And were you appointed?
We
do appreciate your assistance to the court and to your client very much, and thanks as well to the government. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.